Good evening, everyone. This is host Terry Lynn Coop with the Blue Plate Special. And tonight on the menu are Mike Ventrella and Mark Arnold and their look at 1960s pop culture phenomenon, The Monkees. Their book, long title, Looking for the Good Times, Examining the Monkees Songs One by One, is hot off the grill. Instead of going through the introduction, I'm just going to go ahead and get this started. How you doing tonight?
Fine.
With two people being interviewed, it's going to be difficult, but we'll try to keep it straight.
Yes.
Okay.
Make it directional,
go
I guess.
Ahead and, Mark, why don't you just give a brief introduction of yourself and what your writing chops are? I know you're definitely a pop culture historian.
Yes, I'm a pop culture historian for comic books and animation, typically, and music. I've done books on Harvey Comics, on Dennis the Menace, on Cracked Magazine, and the Beatles, and Disney, and what am I missing? Well, that's a pretty good overview of all my books.
Okay. And Mike, how about you?
Well, I do have an agreement with Mark as far as animation goes, because I used to start a magazine back in the 80s called Animata, which is the first major animation magazine. I later sold it, and it went out of business when all magazines go out of business when the internet took it over. So my background is similar in that regard. But other than that, I'm a lawyer, and I do write books. I have novels, and this is my first nonfiction book. I got the idea for this when I read Mark's book about the Beatles, and he had gone through all the Beatles songs and had given his opinion on them, and I said, we should do one about the Monkees. And he went, yeah, and sort of it grew from there, really.
So why the Monkees?
Well, I grew up watching the Monkees, you know, and I'm older than Mark by a little bit. And when I was a kid, watching the Monkees was important to me, because while other kids wanted to be astronauts or, you know, firemen, I wanted to be a monkey. I wanted to be in a band because I wanted to play music and have wacky adventures, because I thought the two went together. So the music meant a lot to me. It really did. And I grew up being a very musical person. And I played in a bunch of bands, and even at one point, surprisingly, we all lived in the same house. It was kind of cool. We were almost monkeys. So the music is what really interests me more than the TV show. And so that's the angle that I'm coming at this book from.
Well, actually,
and
that's
Mike,
the same for me.
And Mike, weren't you in a band, too?
Oh, go ahead.
Sorry?
Mike, weren't you in a band as well?
I've been in lots of different bands, yes, over the years. My most famous was in Richmond, Virginia. I had a band called the Naughty Bits. And this was like late 70s, early 80s, you know, named after a Monty Python routine, admittedly. And I talk about it a little bit in the book. We were pretty big for a while, but there's only so big you can go in a town like Richmond, Virginia. You know, it's not like they have big, you know, record companies there.
Well, I'm just going to roll a bomb right into the middle of the conversation here. Get ready. Where's the Monkees,
right?
Fake band?
You want to take that, Mark, or should I answer that?
I'll take it, since I think originally they were a fake band, but as I explain in my intro in the book, they've actually toured far longer than most real bands and actually became a real band. They wrote their own music eventually. They performed with their own instruments. They sang on the recordings. So, yeah, yes, it was fictional at first, but... yeah, they became a real band. That's how I feel about it.
I will point out that both Mike and Peter were hired for the show as musicians. Davey and Mickey were actors first. So two of the members were already musicians and wanted to play and already had been in bands before. So they were half a band when they got started. But admittedly, yes, they were a fake band, but no more fake than many bands at the time. You can go and get the Beach Boys or the Turtles or some of those other bands at the time, and they had session musicians playing on their records, and they had other people writing their songs, and so did the Monkees. As time went on, the Monkees got more and more control over their music, and by the end there, they really were a band as much as any other band was in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually really interesting. Of course, when I was watching it as a kid, of course they were singing. Of course they were a real band. You know, they were they were very, very real to me. And what brought the Monkees show about? What's the little background on that?
It's called Help more than anything else, really. Go ahead, Mark.
Or even Hard Day's Night. Yeah, Help and Hard Day's Night, both the Beatles feature films. because, you know, you have the in both movies those romps where the quartet are just dancing around on the beach or dancing around in the snow or doing all sorts of crazy things in a park or something like that. Can't Buy Me Love and Hard Day's Night is a typical thing that they, I'm sure the creators, Ray Burt, Burt Schneider mm-hmm. and created, just saw that, you know, and then of course they had thought about getting a real band. There's rumors that they had originally wanted to sign up the Love and Spoonful to do a series, but then they decided to go a different direction and create their own band.
Yeah, I'm not picturing the Love and Spoonful as all that wacky.
Yeah.
I think they decided they needed a couple of real actors at least, you know, and that was the point, because both Mickey and Davey had some experience. Mickey had been a child actor on a TV show back in the early 60s called Circus
right.
Boy, and Davey was a Broadway star. He had actually starred as the Artful Dodger in Oliver on Broadway, and so both of them had experience in acting, and they felt that was the most important thing.
And did they become musicians, or did they have a musical background before the show?
Mickey had been in a couple of bands as the guitarist before the Monkees, you know, nothing that made anything big. So when they started the Monkees, they needed someone to play drums, and Mickey sort of got conned into it because Davey didn't want to be hidden back there because he's pretty short. So Mickey sort of pretended to be the drummer, and he actually learned how to play drums eventually.
And Davey was the cute one. Davey was the one they needed out front for the girl.
Yeah.
As
I could play the maracas.
Yeah,
he could play the maracas.
I have some criticism of Davey in the book, if you read the book, because Davey was the least monkey. He really never cared about rock and roll. He wanted to be a Broadway star, you know, and his music style did not fit the rest of the Monkees. He was great on the TV show. Casting-wise, he was perfect. Music-wise, he didn't fit in at all. Although he had a great voice.
And again, as a fan, I didn't see that, you know, because of course I had a crush on him. I was nine.
Well, one of the things we do in this book, which is different, if I can say, one of the things we do in this book that's different than some books is that we take the songs and we go in order when they were recorded, not when they were released on record. And we want to show how the music evolved, how at first they hardly had any control over the music, and later they got more, and then it got to the point where they were pretty much going in each of their own directions. You know, by the time we get near the end of the Monkees, Davey, Mickey, and Mike, because Peter had left, were pretty much doing their own things. It was almost like three different artists on one record. So talking about the evolution of the music, I think, is important, and that's what makes the book a little different from some of the other books.
Give an example of that. Like, pick a song that you can think of, right? You know, that you can think of off the top of your head, and what some of your analysis of it is.
Me or Mark?
Either one.
Well, I'll take this one first. Well, you know, the first records were basically ones that were done specifically for anybody in mind. So they wrote generic stuff. They had like Last Train to Clarksville and things like that. And, you know, over time they realized, you know, we want to be part of this too. There's a story that Peter Tork, said he was done with the Monkees almost from the beginning because he brought his guitar to the session and they said, we don't want you. We don't need you. We've already laid down the tracks. Sorry. You know, and it was actually Nesmith, I think, that gave, Tork his first chance on a record to kind of like bring it into being sort of a real band. And the evolution starts from there. But it's interesting, and then Mike could take it from here, is that, you know, over time from 66 to 68, it seems like there's this great progression. And then as the various members go off and do their own thing, it kind of falls apart just as quickly until it just becomes the way it was when they started. Here's some songs, put your vocals on it.
Yeah, there's a bit of an evolution there. Yeah, it is. And it got to the point where they, I think, lost interest in the music. And so just showed up to fill their contractual obligations, sing the song and leave, you know, without any real control over it at all. Because at that point, they didn't care anymore.
So, like, what song was the one that Peter Tork actually got to participate in as an actual, you know, musician?
Mike had a couple of songs on the first album that Peter got to play guitar on, because they did allow Mike to have two songs on the first album. So that was the first one. I think it was Papa Jean's Blues. I'm not quite certain if it was that one or the other one.
Have to look in our own book. Well, the peak for Peter, since you mentioned Peter, was really, you know, the progression on the Head soundtrack. He actually composed two of the songs. One of them was sung by Mickey, but Peter sang it himself. So Peter was really, really trying until he decided to quit at the end of 68 to make it really a real band and be in competition with all the, you know, other bands of the day, the Beatles, Rolling Stones, Birds, whatever, you know.
And the thing is, Peter was the best musician of the four of them. He really was good. I mean, you hear that little piano, and he came up with things. At the beginning of Daydream Believer, you know, if you think of the song Daydream Believer, which everyone knows, there's that little piano bit at the beginning. You know, Peter's playing that. He's the one who came up with that little riff that makes people remember that song instantly as soon as you hear it. And there are other songs that he plays keyboards on and plays guitar on and bass, and you go, that makes that song. You know, he's a good musician. It's sad that they didn't use him more.
And what's interesting, because to me anyway, he seemed to be like number four on the show. You know, Mike was kind of the quiet leader. Mickey was kind of, you know, the wild guy. Davey was the cute one. And then Peter.
Well, the thing is, Peter, unlike the other three sort of played exaggerated versions of themselves. Peter was cast as the stupid one. You know, he was he was like the innocent one who was not very smart, which is not him at all. And so he kind of had to play against correct character for the TV show, which is kind of sad for him.
I think this about Peter is that they were trying to make amends to keep him on the show. Like, it sounded like he may have wanted to walk almost the whole time. And so, like, the second season, they put his song For Pete's Sake as the closing credits, and they also did that jokey opening where they credit all the other monkeys as Peter and then finally give Peter his credit. And I think it was kind of done kind of, like, on the sly to just kind of say, look, Peter, we like you, too. You're a useful part of this band, too, you know.
So was the behind the scenes was the show a smooth production? I mean, did everybody work well together, or was there tension?
You know, sadly, we can answer that sort of, but that's not what the book is about. We didn't really research that much. There are a bunch
of books. Well, I can answer it though.
Oh yeah, I mean, we can answer it, but I'm just trying to make sure you understand that that's not what our book is about. If someone's going to buy our book and expect to hear about the TV show, that's not the right book to get. Furthermore, I want to make sure this is clear, because we've gotten some bad reviews from people who don't understand what they're buying, and they get the book and they say, well, this doesn't have all the details about the songs. Well, there's already a book out there that has that. You know, we didn't want to just copy something from the book. We wanted to give our opinion of the songs. So we can answer your question. I just want to make sure people don't think, oh, I'm going to buy the book so I can read more about that, because it's not in our book.
Right.
Gotcha.
But we also have other things in the book too. Like I have a short history. But Mike went through and did the research for the Billboard charts. I went through and did the research for all their television appearances, not just Monkees TV show, but, you know, any interviews that two or more of them had done over the years, and all their concert appearances, which took some doing, because there are websites out there, but not one of them was completely accurate. So I had to compare notes and get everything as best I could for the book. So I think this is the most accurate one, considering all the sources I use. And I cite all the sources that I use. So.
Okay.
Yeah,
and
if I
opened your book up right now, just kind of walk me through, what am I going to find?
All right. Well, first you're going to see both of our introductions, where we talk about what the Monkees mean to us. Then I do a little essay about how music changed from the time the Monkees started to the time they pretty much split up, and how important the Monkees were to music in the 60s and how much they influenced everybody. Mark then does a history of the band and talks about all the music, you know, all the ways from 1966 all the ways up till now, about all the different releases and what versions came out and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of that before we even get started. Then we go through every single song. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of songs, a lot of which were never released. You know, and we say exactly which Monkey played on which song, how high it got on the charts, which album it was first released on, where you could find it, and then we each give our opinions of the songs, plus a little bit of trivia about the songs. Understand that some people will disagree with our opinions. And I will point out that Mark and I disagree with each other quite often. When people have read this and given their said, "Oh, well, this is terrible. I disagree with everything they say." That's okay. Go ahead and disagree, because we disagree with each other too.
Well, that's like me reading one of those lists. That's like me reading one of those lists rating Springsteen songs. So I totally understand that.
Exactly. No one is ever going to agree with that on music, movies, anything. Anyway, after it gets through all the music, after it gets through all the songs, and that's, obviously 80% of the book, then we have the list of all the concerts, we have a list of all the TV appearances, and a list of the billboards, so you can look week by week. Oh, at this particular week, this song was number 5, and this song was number 20. It's very, organized. A huge, big index at the end, of course.
So
amazing.
One thing Mike didn't mention that we both did is we actually did little mini interviews with various musicians and other people associated with the Monkees. So like Howard Kalin, Mike got him from the Turtles to do an introduction for a book. I interviewed Peter Noon from Herman's Hermits. Who else did we get?
I interviewed Tommy James from Tommy James and the Shondell, and I interviewed Gene Cornish from the Rascals as well, and a couple other people. So we got some people.
I got Butch Patrick, who was in one of the Monkees episodes, the Christmas episode, and he was of course Eddie Munster, and Stu Phillips, who composed the incidental music on the TV show, and he wrote some nice stuff for us too. And I even got a comment before he passed, the late David Peel, who was a big Monkees fan and a New York street musician that John Lennon discovered. So.
And Ron Dante, who was the lead of the Archies, did all the Archies music.
Just as a little trivia bit for you, Alex Segura, a writer friend of mine, it also works on the reboot of the Archies comics. And they are doing an Archies Meet the Monkees edition.
I'm aware of that. Mark Wade is also working on that. Mark Wade went to high school together, so I'm bugging him about that.
Well, I didn't know that.
he's a big Monkees fan too.
Well, and so when I interviewed Alex about both his novels and his work on Archie's comics, I mentioned your book, and he was like, "Ooh." So that should be a lot of fun.
I've been very happy. It's been selling pretty well. It's been selling pretty well on Amazon. Mm-hmm. We're looking at the numbers. We're happy with it, and I'm glad that people are enjoying it.
Who is your publisher?
It is Bear Manor Media. Yeah. And most of my books have been published through Bear Manor. So
they specialize in type books, and so if you go on their webpage, they have a whole bunch of really interesting stuff, especially if you love old TV shows and movies. They have, like, a lot of the old actors will write their biographies, and Bear Manor will publish them, so it's a good place to find old trivia, media stuff.
Because to me it sounds like, and again, I made the error that I'm sure other people will make, is conflating the band and the TV show. And like you said, there are already books about the TV show. You wrote the book about the band, correct?
Yes.
Correct.
Yeah. Because the TV show ended in 1968, and the band continued on until just last year when they had a brand new album out. There's lots of music.
Really?
They continued to tour. Well, here's what they did last year, if you're not aware of this. This was a great idea. One of the reasons the Monkees were popular is because they got the best songwriters of the day back in those days. They had Neil Diamond and Carole King, and Neil Sedaka were writing songs for them back in those days. So what happened was, about a year ago, they did a 50th reunion album, and they got some of the best songwriters of today. They got Andy Partridge from XTC. They got River Cuomo from Weezer. They got, a lot of the big bands of today, the Oasis, and who am I missing here? Some of the big bands of today, they got those people to write songs for them. So it's a great album, because I love all these I love all these bands, and suddenly all these bands I love are writing songs for the Monkees. It was wonderful.
And then they dug out a couple old tunes. They dug out a couple old tunes. One was a demo done by Harry Nilsson called Good Times, which they named the album after. And Mickey Dolenz added a vocal along with Harry Nilsson. And unless they told you, you would think that the vocal was done yesterday, not 43 years apart or whatever it was. You know, it's like, you know.
So that was one of the reasons we called the book Looking for the Good Times for two reasons. One is there is a Monkey song called Looking for the Good Times. The second is that their newest album is called Good Times. So it all sort of worked in together. If you notice, the book is called Long Title, Looking for the Good Times.
Yes.
That's a little inside joke, too, because there's a song Peter wrote that's called Long Title. Do I have to do this all over again? So that's sort of a little inside joke from these bands.
Which I felt like when we were writing the book. No.
Yeah. Yeah, there were lots of edits.
Oh, I wanted to mention also is like one reason to get the book is that it has a great cover that we got Scott Shaw, the cartoon artist, to draw. And he based it on the It's a Mad World poster by Jack Davis, where everybody's chasing the bag of money. But in this case, everybody's chasing the monkeys. And so we got the landlord, we got the Kool-Aid man, we got the penguin from Batman, Jimi Hendrix, and everybody else chasing after him. And it wraps around the front and the back of the cover.
And that's what I was going to mention is, you know, when you look at it, like, say, just on, you know, on an online bookstore, you don't get the effect of the full fold-out cover. And isn't it true that you decided not to have back jacket or, you know, what's the word I want, back cover blurbs or anything like that because you wanted the artwork to wrap around?
The art was so good that we decided let's not put any words there to distract. So there's no like blurb on the back cover like there is usually on a back cover. If you go to our webpage, which is monkeys.wordpress.com, you see a blowed up picture of it. You can look at it real cool. And if you look at all the people on the cover, on the back cover, especially if you're a Monkees fan, you'll recognize characters from the TV show and the Monkees movie Head. So there's lots of everyone is somebody, not just random people. So it's really a lot of fun.
I mean, and references and to some of the songs, like Zorn Zam and stuff like that. So.
Yeah.
And who's the artist again?
Scott Shaw.
Scott Shaw
is the biggest.
He's worked for Hanna-Barbera. He's done Flintstones. His own character was Captain Carrot in the 80s, done for DC Comics. But he's done a lot of different artwork over the years.
And he also designed the last couple of Monkees albums for Rhino Records.
Really?
So there's our connection there.
when he was asked
to do the cover, he was thrilled. He loved it.
Yeah. And he got Rocky Rhino on there. Rocky Rhino is the mascot for Rhino Records, which owns virtually all the Monkees music. So there's a connection that way, too. And Scott Shaw used to draw the Rhino Records catalogs in the past when they used to issue print catalogs. So.
Oh, my gosh. And to me, the nice Mad Magazine look to it, too, as well.
Yeah. Oh, Scott's a big Mad Magazine fan, as am I. So, yeah, we knew what we were getting when we asked him to do the cover. So.
Well, this is a fun book.
Yeah.
You know, we wanted it to be fun. And there's a lot of humor in it because our comments sometimes are kind of funny. So hopefully people will.
Like what? Give me one. Give me a comment.
Oh, you don't want to hear my comment about the song, I'll Be True to You. Is it I'll Be True to You? There's like a terrible, terrible song that I cannot stand. I think it's the worst Monkees song ever. My comments about it are pretty bad. I don't want to really go into a lot of detail. And I don't have the book in front of me, unfortunately, to tell you.
The one I like, which I can find.
Sorry? Mark, you were saying?
Oh, I'm trying to find something. You can say your favorite Monkee song while I'm looking for this up, because the one I wanted to comment on.
My favorite Monkee song changes from time to time. You know, I think Pleasant Valley Sunday is a perfect pop song. You know, it's a great Carole King song, and they played it wonderfully. Mike plays that little lead at the beginning that really hooks the song perfectly. I really have a strong feeling for Randy Scout Git, which is Mickey's song that he wrote. The one that says, "Why don't you cut your hair?" You know, no one knows it from the title unless you have the album, I guess. Daydream Believer is always fun to listen to. I mean, their two big hits were I'm a Believer and Daydream Believer. I can't think of any other band that has Believer as their two biggest hits. But there's
Boy,
a lot
like
of
a final. That's like a Final Jeopardy question right there.
Yeah. Name a band where their two biggest hits were had Believer in the title. Yeah.
Right. And I like both of those. I like the Porpoise song, which is the theme song from Head. I like, you know, just different Nesmith ones, Daily Nightly, What Am I Doing Hanging Around, you know, just various different ones that just are, you know, fascinating listening. So,
but it's a lot of crappy ones in there, too. I mean, I don't want anyone to think that this is a
yeah. Yeah.
If they buy this book, we're going to talk about the good and the bad. You know?
I don't think there's a band out there that doesn't have its, you know, B tracks.
The one I was talking about. No, I'll read from the book. So this is an example of Mike and I trying to be funny. So Stu Phillips composed a song called "I Love You Really," which ironically they've reissued various versions in a recent More of the Monkees box set. And it says, amazingly, with virtually everything by the Monkees being released, this song has not. Now, it was since this book has been published. And I go on, it's really Davey kind of scat singing the words, "Baby, I love you, really, I do," in various orders and slightly different tempos and inflections, blah, 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 blah. And then Michael says, "Not sure this is a real song. It's just a comedy bit from the TV show. Sure, this one should be mentioned in the book." And I wrote, we should give Stu his due. At least he interviewed with me. So, you know,
it sounds like a lot of fun. I mean, both. I mean, it's definitely a research volume. You know, for someone who wants to settle that argument over dinner about a certain, you know, monkey song or monkey's appearance. But it also just sounds like you had a lot of fun with it too, going into the actual nuts and bolts of the music.
I found the thing. The day we fall in love, and I'm saying a few excerpts from my comments. This is the worst monkey song ever. Cringeworthy, hardly a song at all. Just Davey talking, appealing to 12-year-old girls in 1966 and nobody else. Do you know what the real test of quality is? Time. If people are still listening to your music 50 years later, that's a good sign that the music is good. You know what they're specifically not listening to 50 years later? The goddamn Day We Fall in Love.
I will say this, though, is that Mike even thought, aren't we being a little too thorough? Because I listed things that haven't been officially released. They're only available in, like, instrumental versions, you know, that, you know, they're hoping someday to have some monkey vocals recorded on it. And it's like, well, based on Good Times, which is what they actually did, is they took a couple songs where they actually laid vocals on long recorded instrumental songs in a couple cases. I said, you never know. These may someday come out as official monkey songs. So they're all in there.
We even listed the jamming that they did at the studio. You know, sometimes they would just jam before recording, and then you'd find it on some obscure bootleg somewhere. So we listed those too. Let's be thorough.
No, I think that's fascinating. And a lot of times those, you know, quote unquote lost tracks come out in box sets aren't necessarily the best work that's ever been done, but it's part of the evolution.
Strangely, though, with Monkees, it's like, a lot of good songs were left, you know, in the vaults, and some of it had to do with publishing rights, because they really wanted all the publishing rights to be through Screen Gems, which was the distributor of the TV show at the time. But there's just some songs that are just really good. They just didn't release, like All of Our Toys is a really, really good song. They finally released it in the 80s when the Monkees reunited. Rhino got the wise idea of putting out these collections called Missing Links, and that's where they started putting out a lot of these songs that were actually pretty good. And they, for whatever reason, they got lost because you can only put out so many albums in 1967, or the Monkees themselves vetoed them, saying, this is crap. We want to do our own songs. So for whatever reason, they never came out.
Mm-hmm. So. Or were there songs that say that didn't fit the wacky image? You know, maybe a little stuff that was a little more serious or a little darker?
Well, there are serious songs on all of the albums. But there was one time that Mickey wrote a song called Mommy and Daddy, which had lines like, ask your mommy and daddy who really killed JFK. And they censored that and told him, you got to change these words, Mickey. And he did. He toned it down a bit. But it's still a protest song, but it's not quite as strong of a protest song. You know, he took out the line about, mommy, would you care if the bullet went through my head instead? You know, and I said, yeah, that's, I can see why they might not want kids to hear that.
Yeah, they probably didn't need, you know, eight-year-old me turning to daddy and going, what's that mean? Yeah.
Well, that was one of the problems the Monkees had, and we talk about this because they wanted to be taken seriously as musicians, but real musicians and real bands said, no, we're not going to take you seriously. Whereas if I think people had heard the music under a different name, they would have gone, hey, this is great stuff, but they refused to take them seriously, and that's got to be frustrating for them. And that's why I think 50 years later, the people are now trying to take them, starting to take them a little more seriously. It's very nice. They're getting a little bit of a recognition for what they did.
So did the show basically typecast them as musicians? I'm thinking in terms of like a David Cassidy. Did that type of thing happen to the members of the Monkees?
Yes, and that was part of the problem. Yeah. They got typecast as kiddie musicians, not as serious musicians. You know, they're not like the Beatles. You know, they're just making crap music for kids, you know, teeny bopper music. And as much as they tried to break away from that, it was very difficult because the studio didn't let them. And then when they got their own control over the music, they tried to make more adult music, you know, more serious stuff, and nobody, you know, the teeny boppers didn't want to buy it because it wasn't pop, and the adults didn't want to buy it because they didn't take the Monkees seriously. So that was kind of frustrating for them.
And in the meantime, the TV show, after it ran its course on network, instead of putting it in syndication right away, they put it on Saturday mornings for about 6 years. So it became totally equivalent to kiddie fodder, as it were. You know, with H.R. Puffin stuff and Lidsville and all those other shows, it was just another show that was on in the early 70s, you know, so.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember it. I remember it well in the 70s, along with H.R. Puffin stuff, another show that was actually a lot deeper and more sophisticated
than,
you know, my kid self came, you know, got through to me.
Exactly.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
So are there any more projects are on the horizon now that you've had time to sleep?
Not together, although if the Monkees put out another album, we'll probably update the book.
We've talked about a few ideas, but nothing in tandem officially yet. I mean, if something happens, obviously we'll announce it. I have 3 book projects myself that I'm working on over the next couple of years. I have a book on Warren Kremer, who is the primary artist on Castor and Richie Rich over at Harvey Comics. And then I have a book on Alvin and the Chipmunks. And then I have a book about, I did a book about 10 years ago about Total Television, the people who did Underdog and Tennessee Tuxedo. And in the intervening 10 years, I got a lot more information. And I was just going to do a revised version of the book, but then I got in hold of one of the owner's daughters. All the owners have passed away since I interviewed them. And she wanted to do some sort of scrapbook. She has tons and tons of art. And so I'm working with her on that project. But that will probably be out in like 2020. So that shows you how far in advance I'm working on things. So.
Yeah.
I have a Tennessee Tuxedo Soaky sitting on my shelf right now, just to let you know.
Excellent.
What are you up to, Mike?
Well, I've got my latest novel is at my agent, and she is trying to get a publisher for that. And so we're shopping that one around. That's a steampunk novel featuring Teddy Roosevelt and Mark Twain. It's a lot of fun. I am editing 2 anthologies right now. One's called Tales of Pratanus, which is a series of fantasy stories that take place in the world of my first 2 novels, which, you know, high fantasy novels. The other one's called Baker Street Irregulars, which is that Sherlock Holmes, if Sherlock Holmes was born in a different body in a different place, and that's got some New York Times bestselling authors in there, and co-edited with Jonathan Mayberry and David Gerald and a bunch of other names in that. The second one of that comes out in April. Then I'm working on another anthology. Yeah, another anthology called Release the Virgins. That hasn't actually finished yet. The concept behind that was every story has to have the line "Release the Virgins" in it. So I've gotten some big names for that, but I can't officially announce it yet.
That is fantastic. Well, both of you, some of these new book items, some of these new book projects come to fruition, will you come back on the show and tell me about it?
Absolutely.
Sure.
And I can send people to my webpage at michaelaventrella.com if you want to see more.
And how about you, Mark? What's your website?
Let's see. I have funideas.50webs. That's 50webs.com. But also you can find me on IMDb. You can find me on Wikipedia. You can find me on Amazon. So I'm all over the place. You can find me.
Yes.
And Bear Manor Media website as well.
Yes.
Great.
If you just
that
go to
fantastic.
Amazon, a couple months, there's links, you know.
Definitely, definitely. That's where I found you all, and I was looking through both of your book catalogs, and it's fantastic. So I'm gonna say goodnight here now, and I've had a great time. This was a hoot. This was like sitting around with you guys over a beer, hearing about the book. It's an amazing project. It's called long title, colon, Looking for the Good Times, Examining the One by One, and it can be found at Purveyors of Fine Books, correct?
Yeah, anywhere. And there's an e-book, too.
Is it?
Yes.
Is it hitting the, it is also an e-book?
E-book,
hardback,
and
paperback.
Yeah.
And is it available in bookstores yet, or is it still strictly online?
It'd be nice if bookstores carried it, but I can't guarantee it. You can go to any bookstore and ask them to get it for you, though. That's not a problem.
Yes, Barnes
and
Noble will order
it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been out for like 5 minutes, right?
Yeah, sometime in November. It was a couple weeks ago.
So, yeah.
Mike wanted it out by Christmas. Mike wanted it out by Christmas. It's out by Christmas, so yay.
Yay.
Okay. Well, with that, I will say goodnight to you, and thanks a million, and I'm sure I will be talking to you more later as these other projects come to fruition. Thanks for
Thank
being
you,
on
Sarah.
The show.
Thank
Absolutely.
You very much. Have a good night now.
Bye-bye.
And listeners,
bye.
Yes, good night. And listeners, that's our show for tonight. I want to thank you for tuning in, and always a reminder that this is that the Blue Plate Special is owned and copyrighted by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. You can find us on Facebook, and you can find our latest anthology called Betrayed, a charity anthology benefiting the domestic violence shelters, which is a collection of stories of crime survivors. Check it out. I'm very proud to be part of that project. And until then, I'll see you next week when we'll have another hot author hot off the grill. Good night now.